Welcome to the No BS Spiritual Book Club's live streaming interview series, where leading new thought teachers, speakers, and authors share the intimate stories behind the 10 best spiritual books that inspired them the most on their spiritual journey. From well-known classics to hidden gems you might never have heard of, the No BS Spiritual Book Club saves you time and money by sharing reliable recommendations from those who've walked the path before you. The No BS Spiritual Book Club, the only No BS guide to the best spiritual books to inspire your own journey of self-discovery. Here's your host, founder of the No BS Spiritual Book Club, Sandy Sedgebeer.
Hello and welcome. Joining me today to share the 10 best spiritual books chosen from his collection of over 3,000 volumes is author, filmmaker, UFO enthusiast, avant-garde spiritualist, and host of the award-winning New Realities TV series, Alan Steinfeld, whose latest book, Making Contact, Preparing for the New Realities of Extraterrestrial Existence, has been described as the perfect book for anyone who wants extensive details of ET existence. And yes, we are going to hear more about that later in the show. But first, let's learn about Alan's journey from would-be psychologist to consciousness explorer, TV producer, and host and MC of the largest UFO event in America, Contact in the Desert, through the lens of the 10 books that inspired him the most. Alan Steinfeld, welcome.
So nice to be with you. Thank you for your invitation.
Ah, you're welcome. So I'm sure viewers can't wait to hear more about your book, but we are saving that for dessert. What I want to know, first of all, is growing up, you preferred maths to reading. What happened to change that?
That's a good question. I was really, it was difficult to read, first of all, because I was taught the wrong way to read. I was taught phonetically, and all I had to do was recognize the letters and know that that was the word. I could sound out everything, but we were taught phonetically, so I wasn't so much into the phonetics of it. I was more into the visuals of the word. So each word, they say you have to sound out, and I just taught myself to read, basically. So it was slow. I was a slow reader. I didn't feel comfortable reading. And so math was a really great way to exercise my mind and see the world that way, logically. But then in high school, this is where it made the difference. We had to take English literature, and we're told to read The Scarlet Letter, which was the first American classic by Nathaniel Hawthorne. And it was so descriptive, and I was very visual, and it was very much, I would see pictures when I would read. So it helped me see that world that the author was describing. And also, the other thing about novels is that you feel what the characters are feeling. So I was able to sense the emotions in that book and said, wow, there's this whole world that I had ignored because I didn't like reading. I didn't like the basics of ridiculous books they teach you to read in like elementary school, see Dick and Jane run, all that. And I just felt like I was seeing a new world through literature for the first time, 11th grade. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And then you went to college to study psychology and uncover the secrets of human behavior, only to have that intention derailed by D.H. Lawrence's Women in Love. What was it about that book that had you switch your major to literature?
Well, I went to study psychology because I wanted to understand why people behaved a certain way. And then we just get statistics. We got very dry psychological, not even insights, but theories. And Freud was interesting. But this literature course, I started to understand there was motivations in these characters. There's psychological backgrounds. And Lawrence, I haven't read a lot of him, but he is very much, from what I remember, because it's been a while, the understanding of why people act a certain way. And that's what I was looking for in psychology. And I wasn't getting it in psychology. I was just getting ridiculous theories that didn't mean anything. And these were people in these books that seemed alive and present. And you could understand their thoughts by reading the language of Lawrence and their passion. You know, he's very much into passion. And that was, you know, we're here to become alive and feel our passion. And Lawrence, D.H. Lawrence, is one of the best at doing that. So, yeah, I got into literature. I studied Shakespeare. And then Joyce, James Joyce, which we'll talk about, became like the kind of author I dived into the deepest. And, we'll talk about how that was a big influence on me. But thank you for asking that.
So let's start with your list. The first one on your list is Journey to Ixtlan, The Lessons of Don Juan by Carlos Castaneda, which does come up quite frequently on people's lists. Mm-hmm. And that book was published in 1972. So tell us when it came into your life and what your response to it was.
Well, Castaneda was an anthropology student in UCLA, and he wanted to study the peyote cult of the Southwest Indians. So he saw this teacher, Don Juan. But in his first two books, he describes his journeys on peyote and all these mescalino. But in the third book, which is The Journey to Ixtlan, he says, you know, it wasn't about all those plants, those hallucinogenic plants. It was about a spiritual understanding of our relationship to the earth, to the cosmos. So that book sort of set me on this understanding of what shamanism was all about. It wasn't hallucinogenics. It was about, as Castaneda says, becoming a people of knowledge, seers, not brujas. Sorcerers, which is what he describes his teacher Don Juan in the first two books. In the third book, he says, oh, this is a man of knowledge. And in that knowledge, there are these spiritual insights that talk about the bigger reality, how to see beyond the ordinary dimensions. And that also, reading that, activated an awareness that there is more than just the physical world. So that was a great opening for me.
Do you remember how old you were when you read it?
I was, I think it was after college, maybe 20 something, 25. And I read all those books. He has about 8 books out by then, that must have been the 80s. I read them all one summer. So I started with those first two, and then the third one, it started to make sense, Journey to Ixtlan and Tales of Power, and these mystical journeys that weren't about hallucinogenic plants. So, 25 is when I was first discovering what they called, I'm sure you remember, the New Age in the 80s, and it became like the Old Age by the end of the 80s. So I'm still very much New Age, even though it does have a sort of bad name. But yes, it was around that.
So book number two is another one that, you know, consistently comes up, not surprisingly. Autobiography of a Yogi by Paramahansa Yogananda, published in 1946.
That, I do talk a lot of people, and that is a breakthrough book for a lot of people. I wasn't so much interested in yoga and yogis, but I did pick up that book because it's his personal journey, his going from a kind of questing of knowledge to finding knowledge. And he's very personable in the writing of that book. It's very, he's talking to the reader. And I thought that was great. And I realized there was a great tradition in India of mysticism. That was exciting. I eventually went to India a few times, although I don't think I want to go back, but I went a few times, and it was very, it's a whole other world, India. And Yogananda opened me up to those realities, really. He did. So thank you.
Book number three is an enormously popular New Age classic and by one of my favorite people, The Crack in the Cosmic Egg, New Constructs of Mind and Reality by Joseph Chilton Pierce. That was published in 1971, and I will forever regret that I never got a chance to speak to him. Did you?
I don't think, maybe briefly once, but it was also when he was older and he was in touch with the material he wrote in the 70s. And Beyond the Crack in the Cosmic Egg is also where he goes even further. And, you know, the cosmic egg is this doorway into these other realities based on his Kundalini awakening. And he really broke down the matrix, the mind, the conditioning of us in the West, of to think a certain way. And that crack is us getting out of the box of this limited way of thinking and seeing, wow, there is a soul in the Western tradition, not just in the Eastern tradition, and that we are capable of tapping into these great parts of ourselves, these potentials that no one had talked about. And he talked about his own awareness that he was greater than his education, his mind, his brain. We are basically brainwashed in the West to think a certain way. And that book, The Crack, is the crack in that mind control matrix. So that's an important book, I think, for anyone. And Beyond the Crack and those books, and then the other books he did afterwards, are also valuable, because he was a brilliant guy, and he also was good friends with Robert Monroe at the Monroe Institute. So there was this crossover into
my favorite book of his is Magical Child, which I think is required reading for any parent.
Oh, thank you for that. Yes, his educational ideas are very important. That's a good one. I think I have it, but I don't think I've read the whole thing. Thank you, Sandy. Thank you.
So, book number four. Now, this is one that I haven't come across. It is The Red Lion, The Elixir of Eternal Life by the Hungarian writer Maria Zerpes, and this was published in 1946.
It was published in 1946, but it had been written 15 or 20 years earlier, but it was suppressed because of the war, and it was still sort of suppressed because it was so radical. So this book was first very important to me personally. It's the history of alchemy told through the eyes of an initiate who takes, do you know about alchemy? Do you know the levels of alchemy? So there's something called the Red Lion, which is an elixir that opens up the psyche to how to create the elixir of life, basically. But the book is about this initiate taking that red lion too early in his spiritual development. And he goes down into the darkness of his soul. And you follow the character of lifetime after lifetime, from a very low level of consciousness to his evolution. And it's about four or five lifetimes, this book, and it's a novel, but you're going through his dark night of the soul and all his trials and tribulations, and until finally he raises up in like the third or fourth lifetime to see the illusion of those dramas, and he meets his teacher, Saint Germain. And so Saint Germain becomes a big part of the last part of that book, and it's an evolution of the soul on a journey to being the master, the magi, the magus. And so I have a personal relationship to the book because I discovered that book in an outhouse in Hawaii. I was on vacation and this book was laying around. And I found out a woman who was actually dying, bought that book for all her friends on Maui. And she wanted them to know this story of, because it traces the history of alchemy as well. But I read this and found it and realized it was going out of print because it was published originally in Nashville by a Hungarian translator. And I brought this book to a publisher and I said, you know, this is a fantastic book and no one had really heard of it. So I brought it to the Raptor School, actually. And this woman, Michelle Hawkins, who had Horace Publishing, decided to get the English rights for that book and republish it. And that's why we know about that book today, is because I found it, brought it there, and it was at least the English edition was saved. And now I reckon you're going to love this book, Sandy. You are. This is what it's probably my favorite book on the list, if you must know. And it's such a great overview of the alchemical tradition, the Western mystical tradition, and the awakening of spirit. So I love that book. Yes, thank you.
So, I mean, that's a wonderful thing to find a book and then to get it republished. Is that the only one that you've done that with?
Yes, because I mean, most of the books are books that are out there. That just happened to fall into my lap. And I knew there weren't many copies left. And when I brought it to this publisher, they realized it was going out of print. It would have gone out of print. And she bought the rights to it because she was a publisher and had a better translation from the Hungarian, because Maria Zapis was a Hungarian writer. Very mystical. I think she has a few other mystical books you might like to see. And she was not known in the West, except for, I think this woman found that the Hungarian family was living in Nashville, and that woman brought that book from Nashville to Hawaii. And then I think it's gotten to be a very popular book. So read it. I'd like to know what you think of that book. It's intense. It goes into the dark side and into the light, but it covers the range of human emotion and the experiences of the soul. You know, my teacher said you have to know all aspects of the human experience in order to own the experience. So you get off the wheel of incarnation. If it's all just light and love, that's great, but you don't really understand the totality of the human experience. And so, you know, it doesn't mean you have to do everything, but you can feel. We're here to feel what it is to be human, the totality of that human experience. So that book helps in that manner. Yes.
Well, that's a wonderful story, and it's a great service that you've done.
I did it because I love that book and I wanted people to read it too. So I brought it to these people and said, do something here. But thank you. Yes. I'd love to find old classics. There are some great old classics that people have taught. Like I wrote in my biography, if you want to learn something new, read an old book.
I always go looking at the books that are on people's lists. And, you know, from time to time, I come across one that you just can't get unless you're willing to pay $150 or something. And, you know, it would be lovely to have a company that specializes in bringing them back to life.
Yes. Well, look for that book. I think you can still get it on Amazon for a good price. I mean, there's other classics. I haven't even, like Jean Gebser. Gebser was a big influence, The Ever-Present Origin. It's not a novel. It's one of the first really academic, multicultural understanding. I think it influenced Joseph Campbell, Terence McKenna. It influenced Ken Wilber. Gebser is a very important author, I think, writing in the 1920s and 30s. And he puts together a lot of connections that had influenced all these thought leaders that we're hearing about today. So I didn't put that on the list. I haven't finished reading it because it's very dense. But yes.
So book number five, another one that comes up often, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, An Inquiry into Values, by Robert M. Persig. And that was 1974.
Actually, I think I read that pretty much around the time it came out. I don't usually read it, but it was on the bestseller list. And if you read that story, there's a motorcycle ride this guy's taking cross country with his son. And he starts out very academic, materialistic, but he's also a philosopher. So he starts out with Aristotle, understanding of the density of things, and through the progression of that journey, he becomes more Platonic, like the ideas, the realms of the higher causality, which wasn't Aristotelian, it was Platonic. But he also traces the Western mystical tradition through Western philosophy, which we forget about. We're not even taught that in philosophy classes. We're talking, it's very logic-based. But Socrates was a mystic. He was a real mystic. He wasn't just the father of Western civilization. He had this thing called the daemon. He would stare into space and get messages on a soul level. So we have a misunderstanding of what Western philosophy is about. And this book, I think, really helps to change that idea. Yeah. Thank you.
Book number 6. I love the descriptions about this book, a revolutionary masterpiece of a book that has been described as being scandalously frank, wittily erudite, mercurially eloquent, resourcefully comic, and generously humane. And of course it is Ulysses by the Irish novelist, poet, and literary critic James Joyce, published in 1922. And this was an important book for you.
Yes, it was scandalous because he talked about humanness, you know, sex and love and, you know, all the things that make us human. And that was scandalous and coming out of Victorian England, right? You didn't talk about things. And Joyce, so after I got into literature through D.H. Lawrence and Women in Love, I studied Shakespeare, but there was this, I was at the University of Buffalo where there was a really strong Joyce department where they had these old manuscripts of Joyce, James Joyce. And so it was a year-long course in Joyce. You know, we started with The Dubliners, which was his short stories, and then Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, where he introduces the character of Stephen Dedalus, who was sort of Joyce's alter ego. But then in Ulysses, he brings in Dedalus, brings in Leopold Bloom, who is the everyman of the Irish times. You know, he's not an intellectual. He's a very kind of earthbound being, which was something I think Joyce longed to be. And his love story and betrayal of his wife, it, of course, is so genius. It traces the journey of Odysseus or Ulysses in Latin. And makes it a modern contemporary sort of journey of the hero in modern times. And, you know, it was a big influence on Joseph Campbell, actually, that book. And Joseph Campbell wrote The Hero with 1,000 Faces, which is all of us. And we're all on a hero's journey. And he developed this whole archetype of the hero where the hero goes to underworld and comes back out the other side. And one of my favorite quotes of Campbell was, for the millionth time, what did he say? For the millionth time, not Odysseus, but like, what does he say? Oedipus crosses the street at Fifth Avenue and 42nd Street looking for an adventure. Something like that. He takes the whole archetypes of mythologies, which I studied mythology too, and realized what Jung said, that mythologies are not fable stories, but they're myths to live by. They're things that set our journey and connect us to the bigger archetypes. So Joyce does that in such an intricate way. The other thing about that book is you're inside these characters' mind, you're thinking their thoughts, which, you know, makes it so cathartic. You know, the great thing about literature, novels, is that it's a catharsis release for the reader. You're feeling with, it's not just, you know, those other books were more academic, but when you get to the novels, you are those characters. You are the hero of that book. What they're suffering is your suffering, their joy, because that's the incredible thing about literature, because you feel what these, you know, fabricated, but not really, but based on reality, characters are feeling. And that book takes you through all the emotions. Ulysses goes everywhere with Leopold Bloom, basically, and a little bit of Stephen Dedalus. Joyce is kind of getting rid of Dedalus because he's too intellectual. And Joyce felt like, no, life is about the people, the everyday person who enjoys their food, who has emotion, not just intellectual. So, and the last line, of course, you know, of Ulysses, right, where he's, Bloom is asking his, he's remembering, or no, Molly Bloom, the Penelope chapter, is remembering the, when Bloom asked her to marry him. And they're on this heath, and she goes, yes, yes, I will, yes. So it's really life-affirming, that book. It's really a yes to experience. And it's a little difficult to read, but it's, and each chapter is written in a different style, and it all takes place in one day. But it is the experience of a lifetime in one day. So it's, yeah. And then this later book, I never could finish Finnegan's Wake, because that was, you know, Joyce's Ulysses is a book for the day, but Finnegan's Wake is a book for the night, where every word means 10 or, you know, more different things. Even the title, Finn Again, End Again, Wake, it's the wake you leave, it's the wake of a person, it's waking up. So you have to read it each with an intention. You read Finnegan's Wake, well, how do you want to read that book? So in a way, it's quantum. It's all based on the observer. So, but that's another time we'll talk about that book. Thanks.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to a No BS Spiritual Book Club interview and sharing the 10 books that had the biggest influence on his life journey today is filmmaker, UFO enthusiast, and producer and host of the award-winning New Realities TV series, Alan Steinfeld. We'll be back with more of Alan's 10 best spiritual books and some revelations from his latest book, Making Contact, Preparing for the New Realities of Extraterrestrial Existence, after this break. Stay tuned.
Om Times TV.
Maya Angelou once said that there is no greater agony than bearing an untold story inside you. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, and when I'm not hosting Om Times Media's flagship radio show, What Is Going On, and the No BS Spiritual Book Club, I help people share their untold stories. Books are my life, my joy, and my passion, and there is no greater reward than helping aspiring writers get their books out of their heads and into the hands of those who are waiting to read them. If you feel that you have a book in you, but don't know where to begin, visit sedgbeer.com, click on the Work With Me tab, and find out how my experience helping others tell their stories might be just what you've been looking for. That's sedgbeer.com, sedgbeer.com.
Imagine becoming a super influencer. Reinvent yourself. Invest in your brand, and then manifest your success with a robust spheric approach. Om Times Media and Broadcasting offers a unique and multifaceted way to become the spiritual and conscious influencer you deserve to be by putting your message across our powerful platform with its proven record of integrity and excellence. Through our produced shows, Om Times offers the opportunity to become a social media TV personality, a radio show host, an Om Times magazine columnist, and a syndicated podcaster, all in one shot. By live streaming your show on Om Times TV and broadcasting it across the extensive Om Times radio and TV networks, you become more than a host. You become an ambassador and a force for positive change. Om Times. Open yourself to the possibilities.
There are 16 million children struggling with hunger in America. That's 1 in 5 daughters, sons, neighbors, and classmates who don't know where their next meal is coming from. Yet billions of pounds of good food go to waste every year. It's time we do something about it. Feeding America is a nationwide network of food banks that helps provide meals to millions of kids and families in need. Visit feedingamerica.org to help them feed even more. Together, we can solve hunger. Together, we're feeding America.
Welcome back. Alan Steinfeld, book number 7, 100 Years of Solitude, by Gabriel Garcia Marquez, published in 1967.
Do you get that book a lot of times? Do you ever get that book?
Not as much as one might hope to. or expect. Yeah, it's definitely not in the top 10 of the top 10s.
Oh, because, you know, I think the Spanish literature, the Latin American literature is very important as far as expanding the human imagination, human potential, the fantastic realism, the journeys of people who don't live in a Western culture. You know, this is about a small town in South America who has these gypsies come through, and there's this manuscript that's left behind, and it's generations of families. And it's a difficult book in the sense that a lot of the characters have very similar names. So, but, you know, there's the revelation of the mystical part of these gypsies and their influence on these people and their reality. The book opens, I remember the first time my father took me to see ice, you know, and it's like a doorway into a magical realm, but it's also very human, you know. So it's like three or four generations that you trace its history and how, I don't want to, well, maybe I'll give it away eventually. But, you know, the book that is left, the transcript that was meant to be translated, and this is a little, spoiler alert, the manuscript that's left to be translated by this family in South America turns out to be the book you're reading. So I thought that was just a fantastic way to bring that back around and bring the person in. Have you read that book?
No, I haven't.
Oh, it's a great novel. It's a great
one of those that, you know, on the list, the long list. And the more of these I do, the longer the list grows.
I'd like to know what's on that list, because I'd probably like to read some of those books too. So, I'm just saying multicultural literature also expands people's minds. So, yes.
Yes, it does. Yeah. Book number 8, The Morning of the Magicians, The Dawn of Magic by Jacques Bergier and Louis Powles. And there's a bit of a debate about when that was published. Some sites say 60 and some say 1964.
Yeah, I think it had a couple of publishing dates. I think it was published in French originally and then translated into English maybe in 64. That became a kind of opening to the Age of Aquarius that was emerging and that we're moving into. Actually, this week, you know, Pluto enters Aquarius on the first day of Aquarius, and this is an Aquarian awakening that we're coming into now. Yes, you know that.
Yeah.
So that book collected a lot of the old mystical information, the old Theosophical, Rosicrucian, Inner Earth. It collected a lot of UFOs they mentioned in there. So it was a kind of conglomerate. It sort of was the model for the Aquarian Conspiracy by Marilyn Ferguson. It's like how you get all this information and put it together as a kind of evolutionary factor. So The Morning of the Magicians, I think, is one of the most important books in modern culture. Because those new ideas that were percolating, that became a reality actually later on, were, you know, seeded in that book. The real mystical traditions that were understood mainstream. I mean, there was the Theosophical literature, Blavatsky's and the whole Theosophical Society and the Rudolf Steiner stuff. But this makes it more accessible, you know. And more adventurous. So that's, I threw that book in because I just couldn't put it down when I started reading it. So, you know.
And book number 9 is The Aquarian Conspiracy, Personal and Social Transformation in Our Time by Marilyn Ferguson, published in 1980. And I have read that one.
Yes. That was the beginning of what was called the New Age. That was
We've got some interference on the line. Actually sounded like an ET in its death throes. Sounded very weird, but it's gone now. So continue.
could have been my people kind of jump in there. But Marilyn puts together the whole sequence that was leading up to the Aquarian age that we're now entering. The Aquarian conspiracy is the idea that there's this undercurrent of mystical spiritual literature that is about to make itself known in the 80s. And that's what we talked about earlier, is that the 1980s was a reiteration of the 60s revolution, which began also, let's say, at the end of the 19th century. But the 80s brought out channeling and consciousness. Now, consciousness became another word for God, and all those elements that we are now living in that are now mainstream. Even the idea of health food stores, you know, like there weren't any in the 1980s. And when I first walked into Whole Foods in Dallas, I said, wow, it'd be great if there was one of these in every city. And now there is, at least in the U.S. So that was an awakening. Marilyn Ferguson led a revolution in that time and talked about all the things that we are now experiencing as everyday reality. Ascension, you know, how does the body ascend? How does human consciousness become a multidimensional being, you know, aspects of knowing, you know. That book, I think, is still, I mean, it's a little dated now. I picked it up recently, and because it's already like integrated. So, you know, but important for the time, 1980. Yes. Yes.
Well, book number 10 is The Tao Te Ching by Lao Tzu, written somewhere around 400 BC.
You know, I have a really strange experience with that book because I think I was going through a hard time. Maybe it was a breakup with somebody, a woman in this life. And I was sleeping in my bed. I have the bookshelf sort of around my bed because you have to, you know, I filled up my living room with the books. So there was, had to put them in my kitchen and then in my bedroom, all around my bed because, you know, I'm in a small apartment in New York. So there's just, you know, you know that Erasmus saying, when I have money, I buy books. If I have anything left, I buy food. You know, that's Erasmus. But, you know, so I was dreaming. I was having this kind of lucid dream, and I saw all this energy coming off the books that were on my shelves. But there was one book that didn't have any energy coming off of it. And as I woke up out of that dream state, I said, what is that book? And it was the Tao Te Ching, because all these other books had sort of an egoic sort of presence to them. They're all written by people and they had a point to make. But the Tao Te Ching wasn't really written by, maybe it was written by a Lao Tzu, a character named Lao Tzu. But, you know, in Chinese, Lao Tzu means old child. It's a contradiction. So it's really a book of wisdom that came down through the Taoist literature. And Taoism isn't a religion, according to me and others. It's a way of life. It's the Tao. The Tao that can be known is not the true Tao. If you can name it, it's not it, because naming is a limitation on experience. The Tao is something to be experienced. It's the flow of time and space through human consciousness, and it's always flowing through this, through us. And so that's become a really important way of understanding reality. It's like we want to put reality in a little box, and you can't stop the river from flowing. If you take the water out of the river, you're not, it's not the river anymore. It's just a bucket of water. So there's, you know, Heraclitus' term, you can't step in the same river twice. So the Tao is still a very important book. And I think I have 100 translations because, you know, it's been translated thousands of times. And the Chinese who translated the old Chinese didn't, according to me, understand the Western spiritual mentality. So that language is archaic. And then some people who understood that didn't understand like the Chinese understanding of certain words. So, you know, you have to read a lot of books. I think maybe I'll eventually do my own translation of the Tao Te Ching, because I'm not saying I understand it better than others, but I you have to read a couple of different versions to understand what Lao Tzu or whoever it was actually meant by some of that, you know, like there's I think about how many different stanzas, about 98 different little paragraphs in the Tao Te Ching. You've read it, right, Sandy?
I've looked at it. I can't say I've read it.
I forgot how many there are, maybe 90 or 64. But, you know, one that stands out is that a country does not need leaders. Nature is the leader. It's only when we fall from when we disconnect from nature that we need leaders. When we fall even further, we need laws. And then, you know, and so it's a great summation of how the world could be if people followed the Tao, the true natural flow of time and space through existence. That's the Tao, I mean, to me. And you can't name that. And it's ongoing and it's forever. And consciousness is a big part of the Tao Te Ching. One more thing about that book. The Tao means the sort of flow. The De, T-E, means integrity. It means honor. So it's really, and Ching means text or classic. So it's really the way of integrity through time. It's how to live with integrity. Tao De. The De is really important for that. And most people just understand the Tao, but the Tao De Ching, classic, book classic, like the I Ching is the way of change, the book on the way of changes. But the Tao Te Ching, no one wrote that. It kind of came through my understanding because there was no ego attached to it. That was the revelation I had in that dream state when I saw that those energies coming off those bookshelves. Anyway, that's my little story about the Tao Te Ching.
So. And that's the 10th book on your list. So now we get to talk about you and the dessert that I promised our viewers, which is talking about your new book, Making Contact, Preparing for the New Reality of Extraterrestrial Existence. And this has been described as, embracing the most exalted moment in history, meeting the cosmic others. So tell me about the book. Why have you written it now?
Well, first of all, it's in the news. I mean, there's the U.S. government has finally acknowledged after 77 years since Roswell, yes, there are things in the sky that we can't explain. This was been denied for all that time. And they kept, no, people are seeing things and making things up and there's nothing out there. And we would tell you, but we've been lied to basically. And now finally the truth is coming out because there's whistleblowers inside these UFO programs that are saying, yes, we've seen crash retrieval. We've seen bodies. I mean, no one really knows what's going on. So this book is really told from the perspective of 11 different authors and I became obsessed with the subject because I think I had an experience and wanted to know everything about it. So I went to all the conferences, met all the key people like John Mack, who's no longer with us, but was a Harvard psychiatrist who said, no, these people aren't crazy or having experiences. You know John Mack's work?
I do.
So I met John and Bud Hopkins and Whitley Strieber and Linda Moulton Howe. Actually, you have a essay by John Mack, even though he's no longer with us. I talked to his archivist, and it's the first time this essay is in print in this book. So the book is 11 different essays, including my own, told from different perspectives about this UFO phenomena, because no one has the whole truth. You know, in their essay by JJ and Desiree Hertog, who are good friends of mine. That's a book that should be on your top 10 list, The Keys of Enoch. Do you know that book?
I do know that book.
Right. I'm actually sitting in their home right now. But anyway, but so all these great researchers and scholars have contributed to this book to give this big perspective about what could really be going on. And I don't think the government knows the whole secret. I don't think even the experiencers know. We need it to, because it hasn't all been revealed. We're in this huge time of transition, from an old age to a new age, from an old way of thinking about our place in the cosmos. Like Darwinian theory says, life is a freak of nature, it's accidental. But then you talk to people like Bruce Lipton, who I just saw recently, said, no, life isn't an accident. And I say, not only is it not an accident, it's an emergent property. So we're not the only place in creation that has sentient life. It's everywhere. And we've been, I think, lied to. Also, the materialistic point of view has kept us in this little box thinking, no, it's all causal accidents and nothing has any meaning. But when you realize that life is an emergent property of creation itself, means that it's everywhere, and consciousness is not an aspect of entropy, but of complexity, then you see maybe there's a meaning to everything that happens and everything we see and our interactions. And that's what literature does too. It gives meaning to people's lives. You know, great books do that. And I tried to do that in this book, kind of give an overview. So the subtitle is Preparing for the New Realities, which is my kind of company name, New Realities of Extraterrestrial Existence. Preparing is you need to know something's there. Otherwise, you know, you're surprised, you're shocked. But this book opens people up. I'll tell you an interesting story if you want to know about preparation. Like, so it's a little embarrassing, this story, but I'll tell it anyway. So I'm sitting in my apartment writing, not this book, but something else. And, you know, I'm all alone. And, you know, I'm thinking about the aliens and all that because, you know, I've just been writing about all that. And then, you know, the door's locked. It's a little dark. And suddenly I hear a little rustling and I'm facing the window. I have a little plant by the window and I hear some movement and looking around, and suddenly I see these two black eyes staring at me, and I go like that, like, and it was actually just a little mouse that was, but it scared me because I wasn't prepared. It just kind of showed up, and, you know, and it had a sentience to it. It looked at me, I looked at it, and it was like, and it was just like, it was the sentience, the consciousness, even though it's probably not that developed, of this little creature that just, you know, it wasn't like a bugger. It was like this little creature with two black eyes. And it's like, if someone would have told me, you know, you might have a little visitor, then I wouldn't have been as shocked. But when something shows up and you're not prepared, even though it's this little harmless thing that eventually I got rid of, but, you know, I didn't kill it. I threw it out. But it's shocking just to be taken off guard. So preparing for the new realities means, yes, there's something bigger. And if you know of it, you will not be shocked. The thing that people are afraid of, and that's been true of the abduction phenomena, is that they haven't been prepared. And this is one of the things John Mack talked about, ontological shock. Suddenly, you're seeing things that are not in your reality. So this book is a kind of laying out of the possibilities and the experiences. I have Whitley Strieber in here. It's one of the, I should give you my top 10 UFO books sometime. But I almost put Communion, which is such an important book that also prepares people. But preparing it from multiple perspectives. George Norrie writes the introduction from his perspective. And I have my story of my contact. So we're coming into a time where we need to know reality is not what we think it is, you know? And the more we can know that, the more prepared we are to meet the others, because they're showing up. There's more worldwide sightings. There's more people having dreams because they appear in these altered states. Like when beings show up, and this has been my experience, it shifts your conscious awareness. It becomes an altered state of reality, because the emanation of their conscious field distorts our conscious field because it creates a bigger vacuum. And some people feel a loss of identity, and it has been traumatic. There is a traumatic, I mean, there's people having space beings and great, you know, experience, but there's also the other part of the population. It's like totally, oh my God, this is not supposed to be in my reality. So if you know that this can be in your reality, it calms, it lessens the kind of freak out experience when you actually meet them. And then we have to rise to the occasion of changing our consciousness so we can meet them as equals. They're not greater than us. They may be smarter. They may have greater technology, but they are equal to us on a level of sentience. And we have to realize that. And that's the point I try to also make in this book. It's like we need to evolve out of this old materialistic way of thinking. Science used to say it's either a wave or a particle, energy or matter. Well, we're much more energy than we are matter. And when we come into that understanding, I think we'll be able to meet these beings more on equal playing field. And that's what they're waiting for, in my opinion. They're waiting for us to wake up, get rid of our weapons. I know there's awful things happening in the world and it's not good, but if we could just find a way to peace, if we could come together as one planet, one planetary civilization. I quote Bruce Lipton at the end of the book. And can I just read this for a second?
Yeah.
Because I think, Bruce was another huge influence in my understanding of who we are and why we're here. So Bruce says, the next level of our evolution is to recognize we're all cells in a larger community coming together to share awareness. That's why we read books, to share awareness. And this sharing of awareness will create a new living organism called humanity. Bruce says, we are not humans until we create humanity. This is when we recognize we're all cells in the same living organism working in a coherent fashion. Then humanity is complete. And when humanity is complete, the Earth as an organism completes that level of evolution. We are like the sentient energies of, and when the Earth comes together, when we come together as a unity with a voice of unity that allows us to speak as a single consciousness, that oneness will allow other ones to come into our field and build the next level of superorganism. So us coming together in coherent fashion, which is what we're doing, talking and exchanging and loving and being our best version of ourselves we can be, we become that sharing of human compassion brings us together into oneness. And when we become one, we could share with other ones and become part. We've been isolated from the rest of the galaxy because of our barbaric ways. But I think coming into oneness will open the doors to technology, to the arts, to so much of potential that waits for humans to grow up out of this warlike nature that's been existing for thousands of years.
If we can't even accept people of different color, creed, faiths, etc., on this planet, we're certainly not ready to accept others. But do you think it's, we are going to experience beings here kind of en masse in our lifetime?
Well, I think this whole astrological configuration that's happening, Pluto entering Aquarius just in, I think, 2 days, Pluto and Aquarius rules these other realms, So I think it will happen. I mean, it's already happening. We just have to get used to the idea that we're not alone in the universe. People used to think the Earth was the center of creation and the Earth was flat, ridiculous things like that. I mean, some people still think that. But we are part of a consciousness that's not even localized to your body. I teach remote viewing, and that's the ability to see what's not here. Western science can't explain that, but, quantum theory can. They talk about the non-local field, entanglement. These are new ways of understanding our reality. One of the things John Mack says, we're never going to understand the UFO phenomenon until we have other ways of thinking. That means non-linear, non-materialistic ways of understanding reality. So, yes, the more of us that can start to adapt these abstract concepts, the more these beings will come into our sphere, because they're doing it very slowly because they don't want to freak us out. But if we start to evolve our awareness, we will be able to meet them in our life. Yes, Sandy, get ready. Prepare.
So, which one of us is going to be the first to interview them?
Well, it depends what kind of books they read, right?
Yeah, indeed.
No, well, yes. No, it's been fun. Yes.
It's been great fun, Alan. And thank you so much for adding your 10 best spiritual books to the No BS Spiritual Book Club's library recommendations. And making contact, preparing for the new realities of extraterrestrial existence, is published by St. Martin's Essentials. And Alan and I will be doing another interview solely about the book. And you can also catch up on Alan's interviews on youtube.com/newrealities.
And you can, you can order the book on Amazon, actually.
Good. Yeah. Thank you for that. So this show is also available as a free podcast on the Om Times website and on Spotify, iHeartRadio, and all the major podcast platforms. So that's it for this week. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer. I'll be back at the same time next week with another 10 best interview for the No BS Spiritual Book Club. Till then, it's goodbye from me, and thank you again to Alan Steinfeld. Thank you, Alan.
Thank you.